It's a great story we've been promoting. Just, you know, as obviously today in Capitol Hill, there's been a lot of news that's coming out about the impeachment inquiry. And really what it's showing us is that this country is divided as ever. If you look at any of the studies about what voters think of it, it usually will fall along partisan lines. And when you think about it, you've seen some rhetoric that's come out, including the word civil war, which was retreated by the president earlier. And it makes you think that we may be at one of the more divisive moments in American history. Sans, say, the Civil War. But you'd be hard-pressed to find that that's not the case, that there have been other times in American history, modern American history, where we've seen this kind of partisan behavior before. And one of the times was in 1947, right after World War II, where the country was divided and it wasn't necessarily unified. And that is the subject of the book that is put together by historians Jerry and Jane Souter. It's called Selling Americans on America, Journey into a Troubled Nation. It talks about the Freedom Train. The Freedom Train came together as an idea to bring America back to Americans, to let Americans see America and use it as a unifier. And they crisscrossed 48 states to get the job done. A momentous occasion in American history. Jerry and Janet are in studio tonight on Extension 720. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Our pleasure. Let's
talk about this. First of all, you guys have written a number of books about American history. What is it about the Freedom Train that grabbed your attention?
Well, what happened was we were actually looking for a project about 2015, so about 4 years ago. And I dug out this book called Chronicles of American Life, 1902 to 1960-something. And so we opened up to 1947 because that was a period that we found kind of fascinating. We didn't know a lot about it. The 50s hadn't come in yet, McCarthyism and so forth, but there was a stirrings going on. We knew that. And we found this little item saying the Freedom Train came across the country carrying hundreds of historic documents, went through all 48 states. We thought, what? We never heard of this. So we looked it up, and of course, you Google. No books were written about it.
Amazing.
There was a one kid book back in the 40s, but that was it. And so we hit the ground running. From then on, we started doing research on it. We found one paper that was really extensive,
yeah.
But we wanted a more personal approach
yeah.
to it.
Jerry, it's interesting, too, because when you think about, I think when you think of the layman looks at American history, you're obviously going to think of the 40s and think of World War II. You're also going to look at maybe the 50s, like you said, McCarthyism, the 60s and social movements. The late 40s kind of gets overlooked. It's not an area that necessarily a lot of Americans are going to go, I know exactly what was going on in 1947.
Well, the big problem was we'd won the war, and so now it's all back to the American dream. Bring the boys home, and let's have a car in everybody's garage. Let's have a good housing for our kids, and let's finally stop having rationing. But none of that happened right away. Civilian goods weren't being produced yet because they were still building the end of tanks, and airplanes were still rolling off the assembly lines. We also had problems with strikes. 1946, they had a big strike year of that, so we had a lot of labor unrest. And then we had rationing because the Office of Price Management was still holding on to rationing some things. You couldn't just buy a set of tires.
Right.
My dad had a couple of tires hidden under his bed in the bedroom, so I remember that as a kid. And it was a very tough time. People were saying, hey, we went through the Depression, we went through World War II, and we made do, and we're tired of making do. And every part of the country had their own particular problem. And that's what, fortunately, the Freedom Train addressed.
And you know, we talked about this partisan world, but there was still a lot of unrest about where they saw the country going, because this is after the war, and that was a unifier.
Right.
And that was like, well, what are we doing? And like we are, we can be tribal. We got into those tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest problems, of course, was that the government. We had a president that nobody knew that wasn't elected. He came in when Roosevelt died, Harry Truman, and nobody knew him from deep center field. So the 80th Congress, which was Bob Taft, was running that. He was kind of the Mitch McConnell of that period, and they had both houses. Both houses were Republican. So poor Harry Truman couldn't get diddly passed. Mm. So the government was stuck. It was deadlocked.
We also had refugees coming over from war-torn countries in Eastern Europe. And people got a little bit paranoid about, are they going to take our jobs? They don't speak English.
A lot of similar things that are happening in 2019. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, let's get to the Freedom Train, because this is obviously to be able to do this in the right kind of way, it wasn't necessarily going to be something that was just going to come from the government. Hollywood got involved. This was almost drawn up in an advertising room as opposed to a great sort of civic idea.
Correct. Yeah, it started out with William Koblenz, who worked for the Justice Department and was going through the National Archives. He'd go there in his lunch hour, and he spotted Hitler's last will and testament, the German surrender documents. He thought, wow, if Americans could only see this and see other documents, our Constitution and so forth. And he presented this idea to Tom Clark, who was the Attorney General at the time. And they envisioned maybe just one car that would go through, a train with one car that would go through the country with these documents. And, that would be great. But they couldn't, the government couldn't finance it. And Tom Clark thought, well, yeah, but I can get media people. I can get business leaders. I can get civic leaders. And so
advertising companies, right?
Advertising companies.
Really big.
Sell this idea like we sell soap.
Yeah. And they had to make it, because it wasn't just, obviously, the documents are the big deal to be able to see the Constitution or whatever, but they needed to make it sing.
Well, the real problem was money, because the government was busted also at that time. And the whole idea was one passenger car hooked on the back of freight trains that would be taken from city to city, put on a siding, and there is your little museum. But Clark had a bigger thinker, and he said, how much is it going to cost? So Copeland said, well, $20,000 we could do it for. Well, we might as well be $20 million for that, because we ain't got it. So what it turned out was they opened the door to the advertising people and the movie moguls.
Yeah, right.
And the folks who were behind a lot of getting ideas across to people. And they said, right, let's bring them in. Well, of course, they picked up the phone and started calling bankers that they knew and say, come on, they got presidents of banks going around with their hat in their hand. Let's put this together. And they came up with the American Heritage Foundation, a private, and they would funnel all the money. So consequently, the whole thing was civilian funded,
really,
without any government help at all. And Harry Truman put his imprimatur on, and that was enough to help.
And that was the goal. At the end of the day, the goal was to say, let's show America, let's show Americans America. Let's remember what it was before. You said that we're tired. The idea that we've sacrificed so much for World War II, and a lot of lives were lost, but also just so much, even on the civilian end of like you said, rationing and everything else in between. So really, the end game, the end result here was to say, we need to bring patriotism and the idea of America back to Americans.
Yeah, I think so. I think there was this fear that, there was an underlying fear of encroaching foreign ideologies that they were trying to offset.
Communism, right.
Yeah.
Right.
They never said communism.
They never used that term.
Foreign ideology.
Foreign ideology. And so there was that. And I think they saw it because we had the labor unrest. So there was, a little bit of that sort of thing. And so the idea was that, okay, let's remind people what our country is. Let's remind them about the men that fought for our freedoms, the men that fought to preserve our freedoms. Let's get this going again. And so that's what the train's purpose was.
So they put together this group to go through the National Archives and the Library of Congress and talk to private collectors, and they just didn't want the older documents, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, sort of thing. They wanted newer stuff, too, like the surrender documents of the Japanese on the Missouri battleship in Tokyo Bay. They wanted the general that's told the Germans at the Battle of the Bulge, when they said surrender, he said nuts. And that piece of paper was up, too. And they had the flag that flew over Mount Suribachi. That was, everybody knows what that is.
Yeah, right.
That was in its own case.
That's
amazing. Mother of the son that was part of that deal that put that flag over visited the Freedom Train.
The book is called Selling Americans on America, Journey into a Troubled Nation. It's about the Freedom Train in 1947, which was brought back for the bicentennial. Mm-hmm. But Jerry and Janet Suter, Chicago authors, have put this together. We'll take a quick break and come back and talk more about Freedom Train and the result of going to all 48 states back in 1947. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Back here on Extension 720 on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests, Jerry and Janet Suter, are here. They're the authors of Selling Americans on America, Journey into a Troubled Nation, the story of the Freedom Train, 1947. A fascinating unifier, or concept of two, or this concept of a train that was going to go to all 48 states and show America, or sell America and Americans on America. So, you know, obviously that's, let's get to the idea of doing so, because to do that, it really hadn't been done at that point, to have a train that had gone across 40, and this was, you know, the time before television, this train was something that was used frequently, but this had not been, there hadn't been a train that had touched all 48 states.
Well, the train actually, it was the first time that you used a train as a communicator, too, as well, because it was the one thing that reached most of the towns in the United States. Everybody had a train station, and those train stations all became kind of town halls, because every town that was got in on the train station visit, 9,000 to 10,000 people a day visited that train. Mm-hmm. And it was it didn't just travel alone. There was also a whole passel of collateral information that went along with it. Every town had to have one of these, what did they call that again?
Rededication weeks, yeah. Yes. There would be the people from the American Heritage Foundation, the representatives, would come to the town 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time and say, this is what we want you to do. A week of each day of that week, that rededication week, would be devoted to, say, education.
Civics lesson,
farmers,
right, right,
whatever,
right.
Segment of society. Parades. There right. was collateral material. There was the Freedom Pledge. All these aspects of it had to come together. And what amazed us was that all 300 of those towns bought into it. They said, yeah, okay. If
because
we can have the train come here, we'll do whatever you say.
It'd be so, to think about it now, it'd be really difficult because, you know, obviously trains notwithstanding, but just the idea of a government coming in saying, I need to get a pledge out of you. You need to throw a parade for this country in your town. All that kind of stuff, you know, has gone by the wayside when it comes to what we see to be freedom and to nationalism and things
Although,
like that.
Although, of course, it wasn't the government. It was still the American
Heritage Foundation.
But,
right.
But the fact that anybody, any group of people could bring this off.
And that collateral stuff also brought in, Irving Berlin wrote a song all about make way for the Freedom Train, and Bing Crosby sang it, and it would hit the pop charts. And you had radio dramas, you had movies.
They had that was all together,
all of this stuff
comic
going
books,
along
right.
with it. So everybody really pitched in to push this thing. And when you walk through the train, we can talk about the train itself, actually. Mm-hmm. It'd be a good time.
Yeah.
The train itself was 7 cars long, and those 7 cars were gutted, or 3 of the cars were gutted with into one big aisle. And all the windows were steel-plated over, because remember, these were the original documents. These weren't copies. And that's why they had 27 Marines in their blues guarding this thing. And they had, it was all painted, and it was beautiful to look at, and you'd walk through it, and one reporter said it was like visiting a church when you'd walk into there, because all these Lucite special bulletproof and waterproof and everything containing all these documents and that down this long center aisle.
Temperature control, too.
Oh, temperature control, fireproof.
Right, they had to keep
the
stuff cool.
Because the train itself, the locomotive, could do 120 miles an hour. It was the latest diesel engine there was. They limited it to 50 miles an hour for the whole trip because of what was on there. And all of the 52 railroads that gave the tracks up to it, they had all the switches would be spiked 200 yards ahead of the train and 200 yards after the train. So no matter what crossing it went by, there'd be at least a flagman or a switch favoring it. And they only did that for the President of the United States.
Right.
But they did it for this train.
It's such an amazing idea to do that, and obviously to try to bring the country together, and at a time when, of course, the country needed it. Mm-hmm. But there's also an underbelly, and it kind of rears its head in the book, but also talk, you know, as you look at the history of the Freedom Train, this is a very segregated country in 1947. Yes. Mm-hmm. And there were still some social injustices that were happening, including they wanted to make sure that the Freedom Train would have inclusion with African Americans and it would be an integrated experience. Mm-hmm. But they had to go to each and every state, and each and every state and town had different laws and rules about how segregation and integration worked.
That's true. While the town might have segregated waiting rooms, drinking fountains, etc., the foundation specified that there would be no segregated waiting lines for the train. And all but two of all those cities agreed. Memphis and Birmingham said no. You know, they were really worried about violence breaking out because they'd be
They were segregated towns, right?
Yeah, right. They were segregated. And so the foundation said, well, sorry, if you insist on that, then it's not coming to your town. And that's what happened. But yet other towns in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia said fine.
You know, it still was difficult, obviously, because this is a difficult time in American history. And even as you look back on the history, just some of the African American, I would say, people who the foundation could have used, they didn't use, or it took a while to get African Americans involved in the project to participate in the project. That even wasn't necessarily an integrated project.
There was an undercurrent of, I don't know, dissension, unrest, not unrest so much, but dissatisfaction. Langston Hughes wrote a poem about kind of an ironic
knock on it, right?
I
hope there's no Jim Crow on the Freedom Train.
That's what he said.
Part of his poem.
Yeah.
It obviously reflected what was happening in the country at the time. Mm-hmm. Before we wrap, it was interesting to see that Chicago was involved, and Chicago got a real good spot. They got 5 days right around the 4th of July.
Correct,
I mean, to
yeah.
think the Freedom Train got to come through Chicago. I mean, obviously because of its location in the country and because of it was the transportation hub even in 1947. But the idea that many of these states and towns, and they got one day, or they there was a 5-day event for Chicago.
Right. And well, of course, it was a big city, and they had to accommodate.
Yeah, and it was just ahead of the railroad fair, because the railroads are all knocked to the daylights for the war as well, and they were trying to pump up all of their operations too. So it combined those two things together, and they were right next to Soldiers Field. That's where they parked the Freedom Train, and it was crowded every single day. And at the end of the train, you'd have to sign the Freedom Pledge to say freedom is everybody's job.
Yeah.
That was the mantra they had, and that was what it all.
Yeah,
they
people
all
had to promise to serve on juries, to support law enforcement, to vote. You know, all the things that make a good citizen.
Yeah. I guess the question I have to wrap up the segment is, did it work? You know, do you think that the Freedom Train experiment in 1947, which was brought back at the Bicentennial more for show, but in 1947, did it work? Did we see it as a country any sort of healing or unity?
I think so. I think one thing to bring out briefly is that it also spawned what was called the Friendship Train, which was a train that started out in L.A. and went all the way to New York, and there were other trains that joined it. And they were collecting food for the starving people in Europe, France, Germany. So
yeah,
forth.
Well, it had 40 million people participated in the trains. Everything that went with the train, everyone that saw it never forgot it. And of course, it ended up at Truman's inaugural in '49, and that's where it made its last park. And then, well, of course, the 50s happened and Korea came along, and the news cycle shifted to the Korean War. And the train, by that time, they had to break it up and send it out. And one of the cars is in a museum in San Diego still.
Yeah.
But it vanished off the face of the earth, but everyone that saw it never forgot it.
And for both of you to be in this project for 4 years, and you think about what's happening in this country in 2019, do you see that as historians looking at this, that it could happen again, that we could find something in 2020, 2021, maybe not a train, that would serve as a unifier and bring the country back together?
Wow, good question.
Well,
I think it'll take a few years.
Our history is full of phenomenons and quick flash in the pans. And I think... this is going to have to be, everybody's going to have to put their own guts into this kind of a turnaround, I think. I don't think a movement would work on here because there are too many movements right now. And with the communications we have today, it would be difficult to make a single driving thing like this. But if Congress and everyone can get together in Washington, that's what we're going to need. It has to be directed from there.
There you go. Mm-hmm. The story of the Freedom Train, Selling Americans on America, Journey into a Troubled Nation. Jerry and Janet Suter are the authors. They're in studio tonight. I can't thank you enough for coming in and telling the story. Appreciate it.
Okay,
it's been
thank
a lot
you.
Of fun.